Greetings, or as they say in the south of France, bonjour, je m'appelle Jacques, ça va, Sauvignon Blanc. And welcome to What About with James Bell, presented by the Indianapolis Bar Association. Today's sponsor is attorney Elizabeth Edwards, and our guest is writer and attorney Kevin McGough, author of the recently published book, Finding Your Landing Zone. And today we ask, what about finding your landing zone? To answer that question, our travels will take us to the Raintree Inn in Newcastle, Indiana, to parking lots outside of jails, and to Enniskillen, Northern Ireland, where something tragic is about to happen. Along the way, we will meet deadbeat newspaper customers, accomplished and unaccomplished goals, regrets, epitaphs, forks in the road, and plans for change. I can hear the free music now, and it's bumping, so it must be time to start the show. Greetings, everyone. I'm sitting here with the 2007 president of the Indianapolis Bar Association, my boss for 15 years, a mentor of mine for 26 years and counting, and the author of Finding Your Landing Zone, Life Beyond the Bar, available from the ABA, from Amazon, and from Barnes & Noble, correct?
I think even Target's website has
Target.
It.
You could get it off Target. Please welcome, well, I guess there's no audience here. You could clap, Brandon. Please welcome Kevin McGough. Kevin, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me, James.
Hey, welcome to the United States.
It's a pleasure to be here, I think, on this gray Midwest day instead
yes.
of sitting in the sun somewhere else.
What's the weather like in the south of France?
Bicycle riding weather. The river's up. The sun's out. It's a little chilly. We talked to friends yesterday, so... Sun's out.
When will you be there again?
May 1st.
Okay. May 1st, you will find your landing zone once again.
Absolutely.
All right. So I want to talk to you about your book and talk about, I think landing zone's not just a place, but there's different definitions, I think, throughout your book. But before I do, I'd like to sort of cruise through your career, hopefully in 3 minutes or less, because I think a theme of your book, which I read and which I enjoyed and which I think every lawyer should read it, is that what worked yesterday may not work today or in the future, and you actually need to just constantly be planning for various stages for the next move always, including at the end of your book. It's not just retirement. It's like there's phases of retirement where you can walk and when you can't walk and
right.
when you need, you sit on your...
Called the go-go years, the slow-go years, and the no-go years.
And the no-go years. And you need a different income for each stage.
I think so.
Okay. So, all right. Let's go through your career very quickly. After getting
it shouldn't
out
of, take 3 minutes.
Well, if you you get out of the military... And you go to law school where you are class president.
Right.
And you had to win in an election for that.
It's a student council president or student body president, I guess.
Well, we called it the Bar Association. Yes. So, yes. So, you were the Bar Association president. And your first job was at the disciplinary commission where your staff lawyer. And he would only, Sheldon Bresco, your first boss, first mentor, he would only let you stay there a year or two. He didn't think a lawyer should be criticizing lawyers too long without actually practicing.
I don't know. It was a funny conversation. I was there as a law clerk, and I couldn't find a job in 1980. He said, I'll let you stay for a year, but after that, you need to fly. So, I thought he was serious about that, so I took him seriously.
Yeah, actually, look, so you told me some advice he gave you, and I want to see if I'm remembering this correctly and if you can remember. Do you remember the advice he gave to you? You called him, you were troubled by something, and you called him in Arizona, I think is where he was, or Nevada or some desert state.
Yep.
And he said to you what?
He told me the problem that I dropped on him at a time in his life when he had a serious health issue that ultimately, I think, took him. He said, McGough, if you could see the world through my eyes, you'd realize that your problem is nothing more than a speck of sand in time.
It didn't seem like a big deal to him at the time. And I just want you to read my notes, just in case you didn't think I ever listened to you.
yeah, there you go.
There you go. But he also, what did he, didn't he also say the most important thing you can do right now is?
Is walk out the door of that office, turn the light switch off, and go home to your family.
That's
it. And he used the F word with the light switch.
So I remembered that, obviously, but I thought, and I don't know that that was in the book.
No,
it,
I don't
it
think
it should
that
have been.
Was.
Maybe that'll be in your second book.
That's good. Maybe I can borrow your notes for my second
right, book. Right. But it was, I think I was going through something and you said, look, I went through something like this and this poor man had lung cancer and had to move. And he said, if you could see the world through my eyes right now, you'd realize the most important thing is to go home to your family. So yeah. Then you go on to Greenfield, where you practice in basically all areas of the law at a county seat practice.
Right.
And you work for a legend named Jim Brand.
Jim Brand. He was a great mentor.
Great lawyer.
Great lawyer. He I mean, you've never seen a person work that hard. And he played hard when the opportunity presented himself, which frankly wasn't all that often because he worked hard. He had a drawer full of tickets for Northwest Airlines back in the day when you had a little paper ticket. We'd schedule a trip to Colorado to ski, and Jim would come up at the last minute and say, I can't go. So the tickets just laid in this drawer. Well, back then, this is in the 1980s, one day he just gave me one of those tickets and handed it to me. He says, you're Greg Brand today, who's one of his sons. And I got on Northwest Airlines and flew to Colorado. I was Greg Brand for the day.
But TSA wasn't what it was back then.
No, they were a little less. They were a little lax.
So amazing trial lawyer. So I say I tried a case with you, but I sat in the courtroom while you tried two murder cases in Henry County. And there was a reporter there, and he always wanted to talk to you about Jim Brand. I mean, he was a fantastic trial lawyer and a bit of a legend. He died in tragic circumstances. What did his gravestone say, which I do think is part of your book, actually?
Yeah. The exact quote is something on the order of,
when my time here
is gone and I breathe my last, bury me upside down so the world can kiss my ass.
So that's literally on his tombstone.
It is on his tombstone. On one side, and the other side is a silhouette of what I believe is the mountains of Breckenridge, which he really loved, and a scale of justice and a shark.
Right. It just because.
Random shark.
Random shark.
Yeah.
Regan Gibson is into sharks. We just learned in the last podcast. So where can I go? I'd like to see that tombstone. Is it Greenfield?
It's in Greenfield at the cemetery. I've actually got the plaque been out there a couple of times. I've taken pictures of it and I'll give you the plot number. I think the lady at the desk at the cemetery is tired of people coming. I want to see the grave that's got the shark on it and got this little poem.
So you got, eventually you went to Indianapolis and opened your own shop. It was just the Kevin McGough office. You were renting, you were space sharing. And you weren't happy that you didn't last very long there.
No, how do you say that management and I didn't see eye to eye on certain things. And I went there in February. I left the Greenfield office in February. And by June, I was already thinking, I don't think that this is a good fit for me.
And one of the things is you couldn't control your staff. Right?
Exactly. Yeah. I had been accustomed to just excellent staff. And there was excellent staff at my new arrangement, but I didn't have control of it. And that was...
Or
part of the reason that you leave, you know, a situation where you're not in control is to have more control. When you find out that you don't, then you realize that, you know, you're sitting there with a wife with a good job. Actually, she had owned a beauty shop and a son who's a baby and she's pregnant. And you're like 3 months into a new job and thinking, uh-oh,
this isn't going to work. I mean, it is so important to have clout wherever you work, that you have some input as to what other people are doing, right?
Exactly. I think lawyers are, my opinion is that lawyers are entrepreneurs, right? I mean, you can be in the biggest firm in the world, or you can be on your own, but you're still an entrepreneur. I mean, you're the master of your destiny. And when you don't control, you don't have to control everything, but there are certain things you want to control. And when you don't, and you've been a lawyer for 5 or 6 years, you sort of think that maybe I should go in another direction, as they say.
So Kiefer McGough then is sort of born in June of whatever year that was.
It was June of 1986. I was at a program, and Dick Kiefer was then a pretty well-known criminal defense lawyer in Indianapolis. And he was there. I had a problem in a death penalty case that I was working on. I'm a solo practitioner. And I see Monica Foster, who's a friend of mine, and I asked her, Monica, do you know Kiefer? And she said, sure. And I said, well, would you introduce me? Because I didn't, you know, I was a dope, you know, I'm going to go up to this guy and rub elbows. And so I had asked her to introduce me instead of fumbling along. And he said, I'm happy to help you out. First of the week, come to my office, 9 o'clock, let's chat. I thought, I'll get a half hour or an hour out of this guy and he'll go on to making a living instead of helping me sort my problems out. I was there all morning, and as I walked out the door at noon, there was an office that was empty next to Dick's, and he said, I thought jokingly, we're looking for another lawyer, and would you consider coming up here? And of course, in the back of my head, I'm thinking, looking for a new nest. This office is 15 feet by 20 feet. It's massive. Kiefer's office had its big desk, couch, chairs, pictures of these lavish vacations, diplomas. And I'm thinking, there's no way I can afford this. He's a Keystone at the Crossing. And, you know, 1986, that was a big deal. Still is.
Because of Champs.
Yeah, because of Champs. Yeah,
TGI Friday.
TGI Fridays. So the long story short is that we vetted each other. And I went up there. And the deal was, because when they said, if you want to come up here, we've got a spot for you, obviously. And I said, I can't afford it. And they said, you pay us what you can. There was another fellow in there sharing space. Pay us what you can.
We won't ask about the other guy.
No, there's no reason. And when you can afford your third, then tell us.
It was in the book that you had to make a decision by June 30th. Could you tell the young people listening today why you had to make the decision by June 30th of that year?
Well, there's a thing that many of you probably have never seen called a phone book. And in the 1980s, 1990s, that was where your business, that's how people found you. And if your number was in the phone book wrong and your address was wrong, nobody could find you. And by June 30th, you had to set what your number and what your address was going to be in the phone book. And that's what it was for the next year.
And if it wasn't correct, you
then
were out of
luck. Would never find you.
So this was an important day in my life, Brandon, because the first job I ever got on my own, really, was being a law clerk at Kiefer McGough. And I had many hour, 2 hour long meetings with Dick Kiefer. He is a great teacher.
Excellent teacher.
And he very patient. And I believe that you did meet with him for maybe even longer than 3 hours before he offered you an office. And you mentioned in your book that Dick's mom would often call on Saturdays.
She would call on Saturday morning. I'd pick up the phone and Doris Kiefer would be on the phone. And hi, Doris, Kevin, what are you doing there? You're working too hard. You boys need to go home.
I remember Dick would be sitting there on a Saturday telling me a story or something like that. And I was sort of like, well, if Dick wants to pay me to listen to a story, I will listen to his story. And then I would hear you pick up the phone and say, hey, Doris, hey, Dick, your mom's on the phone. He'd go, mother, I came into work on a Saturday to get things done. Anyway, so I don't know. We'll probably have to cut that out. You know, you make a big change after Kiefer McGough. You said it only lasted 13 years. I thought it was longer than that. I thought it was about 20. I don't know when maybe it wasn't officially Kiefer McGough the whole time.
Exactly. I was there from 19. We practiced law together from the summer of 86, and we merged with Bingham McHale in 2005. But our partnership was from 92. We practiced together for the first 6 years and kind of decided some point, where our practices just kind of grew together. We're doing so much work together.
So you're in your low 50s, I think, in 2005. Is that right?
52.
I was there on your 50th birthday. I remember that because...
Do I remember that one? Some of them are fog. At 50, I think I was okay.
I do remember 20 and 30, like head cake for you or something. I was like, damn, he's 50.
Yeah, it could happen to anybody.
It could happen. Well, you hope it happens.
That's the idea.
And then you told me recently how old you were. And I was, damn it. You know, that's the next thing. I remember you told me I've been practicing law for 16 years. And I was like, oh, my God.
What a geezer.
You're the oldest person I've ever met in my life. So I'd like to just talk. A major part of your book is how you left that. And I think a lot of people, you were doing well financially. I think the Kiefer Goff had a great reputation. When you merged with Bingham, I had lawyers say to me, well, I sort of looked at those guys. I'm in a big firm, and I was jealous of those guys running their own show. Here's what was on your plate. 3 kids at home, a marriage that you still kept together, 50 years, correct?
Correct. All right. January is 50.
So one spouse is important to that financial plan, right, as I learned in the divorce cases I did with you.
This is true.
And yeah, now giving away half your stuff every now and then is not a good idea. So you have 3 kids, married, running a practice with 20 employees or so.
Correct.
Doing, I think, at least this was my observation as bar president, that I thought criminal defense was the hardest. And I think after I was bar president, I said, no, family law is the hardest. And then criminal defense. So you're doing both of those. And we're not talking DUIs. We're talking death penalty work, triple homicides. You're doing real lawyering. And you're doing your disciplinary work. There's a part in the book, I'm reading this going, Kevin didn't enjoy the practice of law very much. But if you put all that together, nobody would like that, no, right?
It becomes a non-sustainable lifestyle for me.
Yeah.
I mean, we're all built differently, get that. But no, that's about the time where I decided that I need to shed something. So, you know, what was it? I probably every 4 or 5 years, I'd make a list. I'm overcommitted. What needs to go? What do I think needs to go? What can't go? You know, your kid's got to stay. You get that. You know, they're easy choice. But in my life, I decided it was a criminal defense work. That I've been doing it at that point 25 years.
Well, I was going to ask this later, but there's a part in your book where you make a list of life goals. You, as a 50-year-old, you think of people getting coaching, career coaches when they're young and can't find their way. You're actually a partner in one of the fourth biggest law firm in Indianapolis, getting a career coach to sort of figure out the next move. One of your goals, and I'll get to the other ones later, was to hone my legal practice to one area of law. And then you also say that as you went to Bingham, which became Bingham Greenbaum Dahl, which became Denton's, you slowly become the general counsel or the lawyer to the firm, and that's the best job you ever had. So tell me about why you decided to get rid of criminal defense.
Well, I decided it was too stressful. It required in my practice, at that time, there was a triple homicide case that you and I worked on together at some various points in that case that went on from 1999 was when I was first contacted until 2006 when I finished trying it for the third time.
Fourth, if you include your kidney stone during voir dire that
yes.
Mistried the case.
Yeah. Thanks for bringing that up.
Yeah. Painful memory.
Yes. Well, we did get a continuance, and during that interim, you know, some of the aspects of the case changed. But
for the better.
Yeah.
New evidence.
Yeah,
and things.
Exactly.
Best kidney stone you ever had.
I think I told you the next time a continuance is premised on a kidney stone, it needs to be yours, James, not mine.
I'm trying to work one up for a couple of cases I have right now.
I don't recommend that as a way to get a continuance. There's others.
So let me take you back. I've been a lawyer for about 11 months, and I sit again in this one of the homicides that I mentioned in Henry County. I'm trying to remember the name of the Judge Kellum.
Yep.
Great judge.
Great judge.
We have an entertaining client, to say the least, who was charged with the death penalty. You you were able to negotiate the death penalty away, and we just had a plain old murder trial, which ends in a not guilty on the murder. He is convicted of a C misdemeanor, C felony. That's a victory, by the way, for those listening. We're very pleased. You go over to the jail. I'm walking. I think I carried the boxes or something, and I'm behind you, and some guy walks up to me, and he says, "What was the verdict in that courtroom?" Mind you, sheriffs were guarding the verdict and standing in between me and you and the crowd, and they let the jury. I mean, it was intense. That I don't think that was my youth. It was intense, and they Judge Kellum's ordered that the jury. No one left the courtroom till the jury was in their car and had driven away. So we sat there in silence after this not guilty verdict for 15 minutes. Sheriffs literally have hands on their guns as people file out of that courtroom. I'm walking over to the jail because you're over there meeting with the client. And I'm carrying a box. Some guy says, "What was the verdict over there?" And it was a guilty. So I turned to him and I said, "Guilty." And he said, "Good." And spits and walks off. We go into the jail. We come out. Somebody's sitting. The victim's family is sitting on the hood of your car. You start chatting with them. Do you remember this? Like, "Hey, you know, how's things?" "Yeah, happy to talk to you." Do you remember this at all?
No, I don't remember that part.
Okay.
I remember how we left the town.
Yes. So there's a sheriff, and you want to go hit the bar, right? You're like, "Let's go have a drink and celebrate." Do you remember what the sheriff said to us?
Not exactly.
"Mr. McGough, this is a redneck town, and redneck happens all the time. I would suggest you get out of town." Do you remember this at all?
No.
Okay. Do you remember what happened next?
I do.
Okay.
We had a police escort to the county line.
Okay. Do you remember how I thought that was the coolest thing ever?
You did until the next day, and then you were scared.
Yeah. I thought that was the coolest story, and I think I told it for years. That's not cool, right? No. I mean, that is not a good thing.
And you'd think I would have known better because in another case in Henry County at the end of it when the victim's family, but it was one of the women who was involved in the incident that led to the fella's death, she took her cowboy boots and stomped my car with the side of the car with her boots. So...
yeah,
I should have known better and should have hit the road a little earlier, I guess.
Right. But you, even at the time, you're like, this isn't a big deal. You wanted to spend the night in the Raintree Inn, the beautiful, I should add, Raintree Inn in Newcastle.
I decompress a little bit.
But, you know, the sheriff's like, "You need to get out of here. You're in danger." And
so I guess I shouldn't.
Why do we go back and do another murder case in Henry County? Why is that not, "Hey, I've done that"? But it never crossed our minds.
No, not at all.
We didn't do this. This is what we did.
It's what we did. And I liked practicing in that courtroom. And Judge Kellum was one of the best jurists, fair. He ran a nice trial. He let you pick your jury. Didn't hurry you. You went home 4:30 or 5 o'clock. There was another 8 o'clock at night stuff.
We want to take a quick break and thank today's sponsor, Elizabeth Edwards of Wanzer Edwards. Wanzer Edwards are family lawyers who approach their cases as problem solvers. They help their clients find practical solutions during difficult times. Their team is committed to avoiding cookie-cutter solutions and will instead seek to craft workable outcomes to the challenges clients face in their family law cases. Wanzer Edwards practices in the area of family law, mediation, adoption, arbitration, collaborative law, guardianships, premarital agreements, and parenting coordination. Contact Wanzer Edwards by going to wanzeredwards.com or by emailing them at info@wanzeredwards.com. That's WANZEREDWARDS. Wanzer Edwards, promoting peace, protecting family. And now, back to the show. So let's get to the book. That's why we're here. There's a lot of books on my shelf that have never been read, written by a guy named Hemingway, Fitzgerald, you know. But I've read McGough.
Well,
I've read McGough.
I got that over there.
Yeah, there you go. So I'm just going to hit a few little spots of the book. I don't want to give the book away, but I would like to entice people or let them know a little bit. You give pieces of your childhood, and there's a story about your paper route. And I think it relates to lawyers as well about getting paid. Can you tell the story about your paper route?
Sure. I was about 11 years old, and this fellow that around the corner, Mr. Creek, wouldn't pay. And for all of you old paper boys out there, Kevin Farrell and the rest of you, there's a that's your profit, basically. And I had a whole book of these little tickets. It was 75 cents a week for the Indianapolis Times. This guy hadn't paid me for months. Every time I went to his house, he emptied his pockets, flipped them inside out, and had nothing in them. And so my brothers and I were into playing Army, and I had all this get up. I had helmets and fake guns and uniforms, and I got up at 6 o'clock in the morning, and I went into the forsythia bushes outside Mr. Creek's house, waited for him. 6:30, he comes walking out to go to work. I pop out of the bushes with my helmet and run up to him to collect for the Times. It pulls his pockets inside out and says, "I'm sorry, I don't have any money." So I went home, and my dad was having his Rice Krispies, getting ready for work, and I told him what happened. But Mom and Dad were both very much, you need to figure this out yourself, before they stepped in. Well, he'd had enough at that point. So the next Friday night, which all paper boys know, Friday nights in that era is when you went to collect, because that was payday, and you'd go there at dinner time, make that way everybody's home.
So you would buy the newspaper and then deliver it and yes. then collect it. So you're out money.
I'm out the money.
Yeah.
So my dad walks over with me, and I can see this. We get to the door. I knock on the door. There's a lady in a dress sitting on a couch. She's got a smoke and a cigarette. She has a glass of something going. Collect for the Times. And before Mr. Creek could say anything, my dad, who was 5'5", popped up and said, "You pay this kid, you pay him right now." Of course, the whole party heard this, and the guy had dough. He paid me immediately. And the next morning when I went to settle up with my route manager, I canceled Mr. Creek as a customer. And that was the end of him. And the two lawyer lessons are the obvious ones. We always get paid. And also, there are times when the relationship is such that the lawyer needs to make a decision about whether or not he or she needs that client. And I made a decision about Mr. Creek, who got over on me for months. And you know, he not only paid me, but he didn't get a newspaper after that.
Yeah. Unlike some lawyers, you actually made your money eventually.
Eventually.
Yeah. A lot of lawyers just don't give him a paper ever again. Mr. Creek, I assume he's not with us anymore.
No, lost touch with him. In fact, I think that's the last time I saw him.
What do you think is written on his gravestone? Here lies a cheap son of a...
Yeah, he almost got over on the kid.
But thank God for Dad.
Yeah, and that's a point about that story, too, is a mentor. That in my life, my father and my mother were mentors, and I tell people that be sure you thank your mentors. I did have the opportunity to thank Sheldon Bresco, and I thank Jim Brand. There's another mentor that I didn't thank that I missed out on, but that you'll get great satisfaction calling up somebody you haven't talked to for 10 years and say, "You know what? You made a great impact in my life, and I appreciate that." And if you can't reach that person because of circumstances beyond everybody's control, that they've gone to the greater reward, then their family member appreciate hearing it. And I had that opportunity with Sheldon's wife and kids after he passed to say, "You know what? Your dad made a real impression on me." The guy that I missed, his name was George. And I was working in a wholesale florist. And George hired me knowing that I wanted to go to school. I just got out of the Army. I was 19 years old, 20 years old. And I worked from 6 a.m. till noon. When the flowers came in, we'd cut them, organize them for the guys that went out on routes, and then go to school. Well, this route came open where you got to drive a big truck, you tooled around small town Indiana, made a decent wage, and I bid for that job, and I didn't get it. And another guy, Ron, got it, and I was upset about that because I thought I was the man for the job, and the truth of it is, I wasn't. Ron was better suited for it. And George didn't give me the job because he knew I'd quit school because I wasn't smart enough to appreciate that in the moment. I was more...
He was looking out for you and not him.
Yeah, he was looking out for me, and I was, you know, upset for the wrong reason. You know, I should have been happy about it.
There's a lot of talk in your book about being busy and how lawyers say they're busy.
I know.
Can I make an observation?
Please.
Lawyers hate being busy. They hate not being busy. They hate it more. Yeah. So it's just you're screwed. So anyway, talk about being busy. Talk about, I think I'm pronouncing this correctly, Sava. Is that how you pronounce
Sava.
It?
Mm-hmm.
Sava.
Sava.
Yeah. You had a chapter about Sava.
I do. I wrote this article in 2007 when I was bar president. It was one of my columns about this idea about being busy. And that I thought the then, and I was certainly guilty of it too, I'd say, hey, James, how you doing? And your response would be fine. It would not. It would be, I'm busy. Well, that provoked me. I got to one-up you. Oh, me too. I'm just swamped. I mean, I just don't know how to get it all done. And it occurred to me how silly that sounds. And then being accustomed to France and how people interact in France, I never heard a Frenchman say, oh, I'm busy. I mean, if you said, hello, how you doing? Ça va, how you doing? The response is ça va. You might get, ça va, I'm okay, but pas mal, not bad, but not, oh, I'm busy. And so I put it in a book saying my message didn't clear 10 years ago. And so it's just one of those things that I do think that it transcends beyond just the sort of chit-chat amongst ourselves to where we end up portraying that on our families. In my instance, vacation time would come. I'd go work, prepare to go, and tell the kids, and you know, just sort of absentmindedly, I don't know how I'm ever going to leave. Well, one of our daughters, Colleen, at some point asked Patty, my wife, she said, has he said it yet, Mom? And so I thought, okay, this is rubbing off. And I don't know if I should be proud or ashamed, but you know, the rumor has it that our son, Sean, who's also a lawyer, has used the phrase in preparation for a vacation.
France is a little more relaxed, it sounds like.
It is.
Different lifestyle.
The lifestyle's way different. Depends on where you are. If you're in Paris, my opinion is it's like going to New York or London. You're just, everybody's on the go, and I feel as a tourist, I'm getting in people's way when I'm gawking at buildings and things, and some guy's trying to get to work. But in the south of France, where we live part of the year, it's very laid back in a small town. And you walk out the door, somebody said, how about a cup of coffee? And that may last for an hour or two. You want to do something for dinner? How about lunch? Hey, let's go visit this little town. And you know, having the luxury of not having to be anywhere, you know, have no court appearances, that does help.
Yeah. So it's like Broad Ripple without the gunshot, kind of. Let's go. I mentioned the list that you made for yourself, I think at age 50. Mm-hmm. And maybe with your career coach, you did say you wanted to learn Spanish. Did you do that?
No, I threatened to. I bought a program, so I'm, you know,
still on the list.
I'm still off the list. And we spent a little time in Mexico, so I at least can get things, but we can't have conversations yet.
Okay. Do you speak any language other than Indianapolis, English, and French?
Those are the three.
Yes. All right. So you did put, you want to improve your French. I assume it is improved.
Yes.
And we had Judge Magna Stinson on the podcast. She's a French major, and she spoke some French and translated the Talking Heads and, you know, the Psycho Killer song. So could you say, I would like to eat a chicken sandwich in French for us?
Je voudrais manger une sandwich poulet.
Poulet. That's the only one thing I reckon. I heard mange in there too as well. So you wanted to get more exercise. That's going to be on the list forever.
It is. Yeah.
Find relatives in Romania. I had no idea you were you are Irish, and you are literally an Irish citizen.
Correct? I am. My grandparents, my father's mother and father, both came from the same part of Ireland, Monaghan.
Yeah. And north. I traveled through there from Enniskillen in March and thought of your family. But my family lives in Enniskillen, so they border or yeah. part of my family.
One of my uncles was hung in Enniskillen.
Oh, I mean, well,
great, 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 great.
What year was
1796.
That? 1796. Okay, I wouldn't know why then. Yeah, I could tell you why. A little more modern times. So who's Romanian?
My mother's parents. Their last name is Joachim. Joachim is how you pronounce it. And they considered themselves Germans. The Austrian-Hungarian Empire brought people from Germany and populated a part. It's near a town called Timișoara, which is it's called the German St. Peter is the English name of the town where my grandparents came from. And so they spoke German in the house. They spoke German when they were upset with each other and when we were little kids. And my uncles didn't speak English when they went to school. My mom was the youngest, so that it was gone by the time. She's the youngest of 10, so it was out. The German was out of the house by then, but they were considered themselves German. So I'm that's still on the list. I'm still going to do that to see. My grandfather said he said he was born in a barn, and over the house it says, this is the house of Anton Joachim, who would be my great-grandfather.
And speaking of Austria, you almost went to Salzburg for a Master of Laws program.
Yes.
You could have climbed every mountain, followed every stream.
Yeah.
Do you ever think about what might have happened if you had done that?
Yeah. There's a good book by a guy named Matt Haig. It's called The Midnight Library. And the quote that I put in my book is that if you would do just one thing different or have done one thing different in your life, your total path would have changed. And that would have changed. That was a Shel Bresco. When he told me that you're out of here after a year, I took him seriously. I couldn't find a job. So I applied for this Master's of Law program to where I was going to work for either a company or a law firm in Paris, but you had to go to Austria, to Salzburg, to learn the technical language beyond just the pleasantries. Although at that point, I wouldn't say I spoke French. I mean, I had some classes, high school and college. And out of the blue, I get this phone call from the lawyers in Greenfield saying, we have your resume. Would you like to come and interview? So I did. I interviewed, and then I had this decision between Paris, France, or Greenfield, Indiana. And Mr. Bresco said, look, he said, you need to go to Greenfield. He said, France will always be there. This is what you need to do. And he was right, of course. But yeah, I can't imagine we wouldn't have met. I wouldn't be here today.
Yeah, well, that might be a good thing. So your landing zone, in part, at least, there's lots of landing zones, and it's different. At least I take it from your book. You know, Denton's at one point was a landing zone. That's where you landed. You've landed in France, and you're sort of left the practice of law behind, although you still hang out with us and write for us and speak for us. What is your epitaph going to say? Have you written it yet?
I have not.
It's in your book that you have to write it.
I'm not there yet. You know, it's like the lawyers that don't have wills.
Well, hell, it's like page 20 where you're telling me to write my epitaph. I just would have assumed you had written one.
No.
That's for me, not you.
Yeah.
That's for the reader.
Well, you know, it's like, do as I say, not as I do.
So advice now, let's just say, what advice you give to the 35-year-old lawyer, somebody who's been practicing 10 years looking back?
Keep your eyes open. In the course of this project, I met a number of people and talked to a number of people who impressed upon me fact that there's all these opportunities out there that sometimes we miss. And by the way, I'm the all of us lawyers. This one young woman, her name's Christy Doss, and her comment to me was, I think lawyers have their blinders on sometimes and they miss these opportunities that are right in front of them. Her story is that she was an associate at a law firm. She liked to write. Long story short, she ends up as an on-air personality at ESPN. And other people, I think the other advice I would give to the 35-year-old lawyer is to continue to grow, that you're don't be a spectator in your own life. And I think that's what motivated me to get moving, because I thought, I'm just being drug along and not taking an active role here because I've got kids and trials and family, and I want to have some fun sometimes. And you know, it's always about the next case instead of a breather that doesn't have to be more than a couple hours a week, even broken into 15 or 20 minute increments, you know, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday morning for a half hour. I'm just going to like chill and think about, you know, am I happy doing this? What would I rather do? Is there a path to that?
What about 60-year-olds now that I'm closer to 60 than 40?
I think the message is the same, that the, what I believe is that nobody got into the law game without having some pretty impressive talent. And it not all necessarily great orator, great writer. There's a lot of other things that make up our personalities, our beings, beyond just the things that are on paper. And if you're 60 years old, start thinking, I really love what I'm doing, then my opinion is, and you go for it. But if there's any question about, I don't think I want to do this forever, maybe somebody is home saying, you know, we really should go on that cruise, we should do this, then I think you need to reflect a little bit on what's your list, to go ahead and make the list, and then make it happen. I was given to listening to podcasts. I just listened to one today where this fellow, my dad used the word spade work, and he would always say, you know, Kev, you got to do the spade work. And this guy was talking about digging, and his point was that everybody is kind of on an even playing field, but some people just go after it, and they do it a little more aggressively or earnestly or put more time in, that the opportunities are there, and that the difference between us, you know, across the world is there are some people that, and now this isn't me, got up at 5 o'clock in the morning and said, I'm going to write for 2 hours until seven, then I'll go to work, and I'm going to do this book, which is one of those things I wish I would have done when I was 50 and wrote my ethics book that I never wrote. Yeah. But no, I think you really have to get up and do it. And that is the difference between.
How hard is it to write a book?
Harder than I thought.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I had a lot of discipline.
It is a lot of discipline.
And things that take, you think it will take an hour, it takes four, right?
It's always a terrible underestimator of, yeah, oh, this won't take that long. No, it took a couple of years and some prodding. I've written a lot of briefs and articles and those sort of things, but I had an editor that I met. I took a creative writing class, and the woman that taught the class had written a book and edited some books, and so I hired her to help me organize this thing, because otherwise it was a sheaf of papers.
Yeah. So you're going to try again?
I think so. I'm still gathering information. I'm reading a book now.
Self-help? Yeah, that seems to be your favorite based on the book.
I could do travel, but I also have been encouraged to take this one and pull it out of, to make it not sound like a book only for lawyers. I've had other people, doctors, accountants, read it and they liked it, and there'd be a bigger market. But it's, for me, it's less about selling the book. I had a doctor who read it call me up and ask, say, hey, I want to have a beer. And so I went and met her for a beer, and she brought my book, dog-eared, filled out. She actually did the epitaph thing.
Yeah, I didn't want to think that far.
And she, but she was very, she said, look, this has really been helpful to me, and I'm going to Florida for a month because I'm just starting my retirement. I'm going to finish it, but there's a lot of things in there that I really appreciate. So that was as important to me as selling books.
It's nice to get that feedback when you speak or write. So we've gone over where you buy the book. You are doing seminars. You will be at the Bench Bar.
Right. Speaking at the Bench Bar. I'm also going to do, the State Bar has a senior lawyers program in July that I'm going to do.
Well, that's it. How do we reach you? If we want to take you for a beer and dog with
take
the dog
me for a beer,
book?
You can, the easiest way is, via email. It's kevin.mcgough1@gmail.com or my website.
Which is, and you have to spell it probably.
Is surlaroutekm.com. That's surlaroutekm.com. On the road.
I never knew what that meant.
Surlaroute is on the road.
Got it. So you're like Jack Kerouac in France.
France.
All right. Well, thank you very much for being on the podcast. We appreciate your time. We'll see you at the bench bar.
I'll be there. Thanks, James.
And there you are now. That was Kevin McGough helping us find our landing zone. You know, Brandon, I want to announce at least one of our big winners today.
Let's hear him.
Well, the first winner is the law firm of Kiefer McGough. Now, I will bet, Brandon, you've never heard of that firm, but that was a place that gave a start to many of the great members of this association. Those great members include partners of big law firms, judges who went on to be head of the Marion County Executive Committee, and if you include Kevin, how many members of that firm do you think became bar president? Just guess.
Well, I believe one is sitting across the desk.
Well, that's not the point. The four members of that firm went on to be Indy Bar president. It's pretty impressive, isn't it? Says something about Kevin and Dick, Kevin McGough and Dick Kiefer. Now, we had one tragedy today, so I don't know if that counts as a big loser, but it's a big bummer. Would you agree?
It is.
Kevin's family member in Enniskillen in 1796. That's not good. Later tonight, we could pour out a pint of Guinness for that poor fella. A big loser we had today? What's our big loser?
You're going to have to tell me.
Missed opportunities. I feel like missed opportunities is a theme of finding your landing zone and also of this podcast because time can be so cruel. But the biggest winner we had today was mentors. If you couldn't tell, Kevin spent a lot of time putting up with me. Things that made indelible impressions on the 25-year-old version of myself aren't even memories to him. I was kind of disappointed, Brandon. He didn't remember the parking lot at the jail. I have said this publicly before, but I'll say it again. Outside of my family, Dick Kiefer and Kevin McGough have done more for me than anyone else in my life. They not only gave me a paycheck, which, by the way, Brandon, that's very important to get a paycheck, but they taught me to practice law. And the things they taught me 25 years ago, I use today to put food on the table for my kids. I'm sure everyone out there has someone who has mentored them in their lives, and we should all try to be mentors as well. When someone like Kevin takes the time to teach another attorney, the true recipient of that training is actually the client and a member of the community. And if you mentor a lawyer, you may impact someone you will never meet or know, and who will never say thank you, but you are making a big difference nevertheless. You know, Brandon, Kevin said it was important to say thank you to your mentors. I got the sense he was fishing for a thank you. Did you get the sense that he was fishing for a thank you?
I kind of thought he was being genuine.
Okay, well, I wrote it down to say thank you at the end of the podcast to him, at the end of the conversation, and like an ungrateful former associate, I forgot. So I am here to say that Dick Kiefer and Kevin McGough and countless others who have mentored me, including Jim Reed, because if you don't mention him by name, he gets very upset. I just want to say thank you to all of those people who have helped me out along the way. And that is it for today. Thank you for joining us. If you'd like to sponsor an episode of What About, please contact Brandon Eads at Beads, B-E-A-D-E-S, at IndyBar.org or call Brandon at 317-269-2000. Special thanks to Kevin McGough for being our guest today. We look forward to seeing him at the Bench Bar. And thank you once again to our sponsor, Elizabeth Edwards at Wanzer Edwards. What About is produced by Brandon Eads and the Indianapolis Bar Association. The artwork is provided by Robert Adams. The Indy Bar president is David Duncan. Our president-elect is Lee Christie. And Julie Armstrong is our executive director. My name is James Bell. I work at Hoover Hull Turner. And the sun is out today. It is warm. And Caitlin Clark is coming to Indianapolis. Hopefully over time, her face will be added next to Reggie's and Peyton's on the Indianapolis Professional Sports Mount Rushmore. And I look forward to talking to you next time.